Stay tuned for The Turning Point with Mike Fader. Today, I wanted to talk about Robin Williams, but I hardly even know how to begin. The reason, you know, it's funny in this day and age when everything is old news the day after it happens. Something like this, of course, can linger for, a few days or even longer in the stuff online or in the newspapers. But maybe that's it already. You know, from now on, everything will just fade to a lower key until maybe a book comes out, a biography, if there's an authorized biography of Robin Williams. But I know that probably everybody listening to me knows Robin Williams' work intimately, either watching him in the movies and or seeing him do his comic stand-ups, clips from those things, or maybe HBO specials or whatever. I mean, one of the most famous comedians, and perhaps maybe the greatest genius at comedy that anybody's ever seen, along with somebody like Sid Caesar and the Marx Brothers. I mean, this guy is right up there. But he had a kind of talent that was obviously right on the border of madness. And I guess one of the reasons it's hard for me to talk about Robin Williams, and that it's still such a shock and it's hard for me to digest it all, at all, is because I felt, and I'm not in Robin Williams' league. If I make comparisons between me and Robin Williams, forget about it. You know, this is not, I don't see myself as the equal to Robin Williams. But there are enough similarities, I feel, in a sort of general way, to things I've gone through and the way I've been and still am in my life. And kind of also universal themes to be drawn from all of this, and from his life and from his sad death. Let me start off with the article that first appeared in the New York Times when the news was breaking the next day after he committed suicide. It says here, I'm skipping ahead, the privileged son of a Detroit auto executive who grew up chubby and lonesome, playing by himself with 2,000 toy soldiers in an empty room of a suburban mansion. Mr. Williams, as a boy, hardly fit the stereotype of somebody who would grow up to become a brainy comedian or a goofy one, but he was both. And, you know, my experience in the world is that people have, about 95% of the people in the world, either deliberately or just unconsciously, have no idea whatsoever that there's something called a subconscious or an unconscious, or that there is an entire universe for everyone right beneath the surface. I know I pound away this theme all the time, but this to me is extraordinary. He hardly fit the stereotype. He fits the stereotype exactly of somebody who would become what he became. He fits it exactly. Here's some additional information that I got online. He was born in Chicago in 1952 and raised in a well-to-do suburb outside of Detroit, Michigan, where his father was a busy senior executive with the Ford Motor Company. Neglected by his family, Williams grew up in a 30-room mansion where he had the entire third floor to himself. Imagine that. Imagine growing up that way. To entertain himself, he created an array of imaginary playmates. Indeed. I mean, he's lucky he stayed sane at all or alive through his teenage years. That, by the way, that quote is from a book. I forget the author's name and the title of the book. It's a book on American comedy and comedians. Of course. I mean, with the right amount of, you know, with the right genetic material, the right amount of talent and wit, and he was going to become what he became. Now, the same character growing up, the same kid growing up in a place where he's all alone on the third floor of a 30-room mansion by himself most of the time, except when he went to school, if he did, you know, go to school regularly. I guess he did go to school. playing with toy soldiers and having no friends. Could grow up to be a mass murderer, a serial killer, could grow up to be a general. You know, am I making comparisons between all three things? Yeah, why not? but he had a way, he discovered a way probably in his youth, and I understand what this feels like. He discovered a way because he had the ability to mimic other people, to make people laugh. He discovered a way to get somebody, I don't know who it was, a maid, a nanny, once in a while maybe his mother or his father, when they weren't ignoring him totally. And I'm, by the way, assuming that. I don't really know that they ignored him, but according to this book they did, and according to the news stories they did. So there must be some basis in fact on this. Maybe he mentioned it himself sometime. So here's a guy who grows up this way, and he discovered that the way to get people to pay attention to him, I discovered various ways too, one of which was the same, that I could tell great stories and I could make people laugh and I could cheer people up by telling them really fantastic stories and making things up and imaginary things that were fascinating to people. Nobody, of course, recognized that I was on the border of lunacy and depression, the same way that this poor guy was, right? They don't recognize that. Why did they bother having him? I don't know. Did he have brothers and sisters? I really don't know. It almost sounds like he was an only child. He discovered that if he made people laugh, that he was so funny and so smart and so quick and he could imitate other people, that it made them laugh. So when he got the opportunity, which apparently was rare, he made his parents laugh, and that was all. That's all it takes. Once you find that one thing, if it's acting out in some way, and then, you know, you don't want, you know, what a lot of kids do when they're ignored or abused or neglected, especially neglected, is they break the law. They break the law. The cops pay attention to them. So somebody's paying attention to them. I mean, I always thought that people who, you know, clearly, publicly, you know, demonstrably break the law are asking for somebody's attention. I know that's an old-fashioned, maybe kind of liberal psychobabble thing, but it's true. Kids who act out like that are looking for somebody to pay attention to them. You find a kid like that, look into their background, you're going to see that they were abused, so they didn't get the right kind of attention, or more likely they were neglected. So here's a guy who's totally neglected, and it always amazes me. The guy who wrote this article for the Times is Dave Itzkoff. Dave, probably, I don't know, maybe a very nice guy, and he's a good enough writer. He wrote an article that was hard to write, I suppose, but the idea that he hardly fits the stereotype. Now, I understand. Here's where I make my comparisons a little bit. I was essentially ignored, neglected totally by what constituted my family when I was a kid. And I was not fat and lonesome. I was skinny and lonesome and shorter than anybody in my class, by even the girls. And I played with about, because we were of different circumstances financially, I had about 40 toy soldiers. I didn't have 2,000. Although when they switched, I had lead soldiers, which they made up until the mid-50s, I think, or the late 50s. And then they switched to, by the time Robin Williams was playing with toy soldiers, they were probably these big bags of plastic soldiers. You could buy 100 of them for, a couple of dollars. So he had his toy soldiers. This is what you get. This is what you get. If you check with a lot of performers, I mean, if you look into the backgrounds of a lot of performers, they are of various types, but essentially they themselves as children are ignored. Sometimes maybe people pay too much attention to them because they have this one talent. But what happens is that they have to use this talent all the time. If they don't use it, then they get completely locked out of other people's love, that there's no attention whatsoever paid to them. And they're lonely. And a lonely kid like that with a tremendous imagination is going to turn into somebody who is going to have problems, and that's putting it mildly, his whole life. It's just extraordinary that people don't see this. But, you know, they don't give licenses to people. There's no examining board. And who would it be anyhow? There's no examining board that gives a license to people to have children. Nobody reviews, millions of children born every day. Nobody is looking into whether these parents have the financial ability to have them. Certainly nobody ever looks in, and nobody, I suppose, has the right to, although you begin to wonder sometimes. Nobody looks into whether or not. Here's a couple of people who were pretty well off when he was born and got even richer as he grew up, who never should have had kids. I mean, if they, and I'm assuming, of course, and I know I apologize to his parents, wherever they may be, if I'm assuming things that are wrong. If you're not going to pay attention to your kid, and I see this all the time. I mean, everybody sees this. I mean, it may have happened to you. You may have done it, not paid enough attention to your kid or paid no attention to your kid. And you feel guilty about it. And even if you feel guilty, it's at least a beginning somewhere, right? You can make it up to them later on. But people who have no ability to love their kids, to be patient with them, to stick with them, to pay attention to them. If you look at a kid in a stroller, if you look at a kid at a toddler, and if you've had one, if you've had a little kid, there's nothing they want more in the whole world than for you to pay attention to them. They have to. It's the way they form a sense of reality. It's a way they form a sense of boundaries and self. They define themselves by playing off you as the parent. And they're able to venture out in the world and do things, not without fear, but with a certain kind of confidence in their ability to do things or their ability to get up if they fall down and try again and to form themselves into an actual self, an integrated self. And what's absolutely essential, again, to this formula is constant, consistent parental attention. Well, nobody ever gets that completely. You know, it's not a perfect world. This is not a fairy tale we're talking about here. But a guy like this, who has the opposite of that, who is totally ignored, has to imagine himself and what he would be and has to go out in the world on his own. So he's always going to be desperate. He's always going to not know who he is. That emptiness, that abyss of loneliness that he grew up with is in his bone marrow, and it chases you. When you have that, and I've had that, I still have it, when that darkness, when that emptiness, when that loneliness chases you, and I'm talking about people who perform a lot, too. So this is sort of the more uniting theme. Performers, and especially comedians, people who are clowns, who make other people laugh. When that chases you, and then sometimes it catches up to you. Sometimes it's always on, it's always chasing you. It's always, you know, it's always dogging your feet, and you run from it, and you run from it, and people become more and more desperate and frenetic. I mean, those are words that describe Robin Williams in all these articles. Frenetic, wired, you know, and all kinds of words like this. So here's a, here's another article that was written the same day. By A.O. Scott, who is a film critic for the New York Times. Some years ago, at a party at the Cannes Film Festival, I was at Cannes Film Festival, pardon me. I was leaning against a rail watching a fireworks display when I heard a familiar voice behind me, or rather at least a dozen voices punctuating the offshore explosions with jokes, non sequiturs, and off-the-wall pop cultural, sexual, and political references. It was Robin Williams. Very few people would try to upstage fireworks, and probably only Robin Williams could have succeeded. I doubt anyone asked him for his play-by-play, an impromptu performance for a small captive group, and I can't say if it arose from inspiration or compulsion. Interesting. Maybe there's not really a difference, inspiration or compulsion, whether or not anyone expected him to be, and maybe whether or not he entirely wanted to be, he was on. And the rest of the article goes on to talk about how people like Robin Williams, and especially Robin Williams, people who even knew him intimately, he was never without that mask of making people laugh, that drive, that compulsion, where if he didn't make people laugh, he would sink into a bottomless pit of loneliness. It's a kind of, it's almost like in, remember those old cowboy movies where somebody would, some drunken, you know, bad guy would take out a pistol and he'd shoot at some dude's feet and he'd say, dance, dance. And the guy didn't dance, he'd shoot him in the foot, right? Dance, dance. People like that are always on. They're always on. And I've been like that in my life too, where you have a kind of persona where you're always talking and trying to control things and trying, and if you're good at it, making people laugh, right? Telling endless jokes. Comedians are like this. And Robin Williams was like this more than anybody. He was always on, and it can be the worst thing in the world.
I'm sure we should all be as happy as. But are we? No. Definitely no. Positively no. Decidedly no. Short people have long faces, and long people have short faces. Big people have little humor, and little people have no humor at all. And in the words of that immortal bard, Samuel J. Snodgrass, as he was about to be led to the guillotine, make 'em laugh, make 'em laugh. Don't you know everyone wants to laugh? My dad said, be an actor, my son. But be a comical one, they'll be standing in lines for those old honky-tonk monkey shines. Now you could study Shakespeare and be quite elite, and you could charm the critics and have nothing to eat. Just slip on a banana peel, the world's at your feet. Make 'em laugh, make 'em laugh, make 'em laugh. Make 'em laugh. Don't you know everyone wants to laugh? My grandpa said, go out and tell 'em a joke, but give it plenty of hope. Make 'em roar, make 'em scream. Take a fall, but a wall, split a seam. You start off by pretending you're a dancer with grace. You wiggle till they're giggling all over the place. And then you get a great big custard pie in the face. Make them laugh, make them laugh, make them laugh.
Yeah. Make them laugh. Every single second. You ever see that? You must have seen Singin' in the Rain, right? When was that made? 1952, 1954, right about the time Robin Williams was born, actually. And it's a terrific movie. And Donald O'Connor, who you just heard singing, was an astoundingly talented physical comedian. He could sing, obviously, and he was a wonderful dancer. The rest of that, that's about a five-minute piece. The rest of it I didn't play for you because a lot of it becomes physical humor, like vaudeville. And it's hysterical. Everybody who looks at that, I mean, you laugh yourself sick sometimes when you see that. But then there's that sense of that craziness that you hear, right? That desperation. Make them laugh, make them laugh, make them laugh. It becomes like some kind of demon whispering in your ear every second, some kind of engine that doesn't stop. Once I, it's almost like, do you ever have a gerbil? My daughter had gerbils as pets when she was a kid. And you put in a gerbil's cage because they have this frenetic energy all the time. And of course, they don't belong in an aquarium or a cage. They belong, you know, outside someplace. And it's the same with any wild animal. But, I mean, you go to the zoo, sometimes you see these tigers, big, beautiful tigers, and they're in a cage. You know, it's maybe 30 feet by 20 feet, and they spend the whole day pacing. Well, of course they do. They have this massive amount of animal and predatory energy to get out, and all they can do is pace back and forth and go nuts after a while. Some of them go crazy. That's why zookeepers figured that they did better by these tigers or lions, when they put them in an open air place with moats and fences, so they could run around at least once in a while or trot around and feel like they had more space. But gerbils, you get these little rodent creatures, and they have a tremendous amount of, you know, did you ever see a mouse run around? You know, like this frenetic energy, like sparrows twisting their heads back and forth, running all over the place, short bursts of speed. And they have a little wheel. They have a wheel. And they get inside, and they go on for what seems like hours. I don't know if it is, but it seems like hours. When we had these gerbils, it drove me nuts because you could hear them in the next room. And they're little scratchy paws, and they just turn this thing around and around and around. And this is the feeling you get from people who are comedians. And I'm sure it's the feeling you get sometimes. It's a feeling I get when I'm performing, especially when I was performing live. And this is where I remember and compare myself, in, of course, in the vast minor league to somebody like Robin Williams. My live performances were so extraordinary to me in a sort of bad way that, you know, because you had to always be holding the attention of the audience, and it's a tremendous strain. And I feel that there's very few people who do what I do on the radio or have ever done what I do on the radio. And I don't know how long I feel like continuing to do it, but it's sort of what I do, is I think out loud and hopefully come to some sort of conclusions that make other people become aware, maybe, if they haven't been before, of something that might be useful for them, something that they could use to help their lives a little bit. Or sometimes, you know, just to make people laugh. Sometimes just to be funny. But I remember one time, here's another example of something like that. One time I was driving along in a kind of a beat-up used car that I had, and it was winter. It was January, and I was on, luckily I was not on a hill, but I was on a straight, you know, a straight road. It was an icy road, though, because it had been kind of asleep the night before, and there was an icy road. And I stepped on the gas pedal. A lot of things about this car didn't work right. And it didn't come back up. It wouldn't come back up. I guess it was some part of it was frozen or some fluid that it needed to work right. So the gas kept going. And I had to bend down while the car was going 20 or 30 miles an hour. I have to bend down under the dashboard. I'm only lucky I'm alive, because it could have been cars coming the other way, whatever. And I had to pick the gas pedal up with my hand. When the gas pedal is on, when the light switch is on, for people like this, they can't pick it up. They can't take their foot off the gas. Their foot is not able to be off the gas. So they have to modulate themselves you know, metaphorically speaking, they have to modulate themselves with drugs. You have to drink when the mania is on you every second, when the demon wants you to constantly be performing or scrambling. It's almost, again, like, sorry to throw in all these different metaphors. It's like in the Roadrunner cartoons, the Roadrunner just whipping around all over the place, right? Very funny to watch, right? And at one point, sometimes the Roadrunner, well, it's not the Roadrunner, is it? But, you know, they're cartoon creatures that sometimes run over the side of a cliff. They're running so fast that they run over the edge of a cliff, and they keep running, and they keep running, and they keep running. And the only time they fall is when they look down, when they become aware of the fact, and inevitably human beings become, who are like this poor guy Robin Williams, when you become aware of the fact that you've been running and running and running from some dark beast that's trying to get you, either in your nightmares or in your unconscious during every single day of your life. When you know that the abyss, when the dark beast there is trying to run after you and get you, and that will be the end of you, it feels like annihilation is about to happen any second. You run and run and run. And if you stop, if you just stop for a little bit and you look around or you look down, you fall. It gets you. It does get you. What is the trick to all this? Yeah, you could say stop running, but then the thing gets you. So what people do, especially a guy like Robin Williams, is they're always on. They're always on, and they figure it's a protection against the beast, right, from getting you, this dark beast, which is nothing but a lack of love from when he was growing up, a lack of belief in himself as a decent human being, a lack of belief in himself as somebody who was worth loving. Here's a guy, and it's a classic case, right, who tens of millions of people found funny and hysterical, and he brought a lot of joy to a lot of people's lives. I mean, a couple of the movies he was in, I didn't like Mrs. Doubtfire, but if you ever saw The Birdcage, if you've never seen The Birdcage, check that out. I mean, this guy, I mean, to have a good laugh, there's nothing like getting a good laugh. You feel down, or you've worked hard all day long, or you just feel miserable about your life or whatever, and somebody makes you laugh. That's why comedians can be so popular. This thing, once it catches up with you, then good luck to even stay sane or alive. I mean, this guy was trying to run to keep his sanity and run to keep his life. Thus the drugs. You take when the darkness gets you, you take cocaine to get up. When you're up too high and when you're running and running and running, and you need to stop because the gas pedal is frozen down. It's pedal to the metal, right? You can't let go. The only way to slow down in your mind, in your body, is to drink. And he drank and he drank and he drank and he took coke and he took coke and he drank. I have no idea whether he ever, he must have been when he went to rehab or at other times in some sort of therapy. But that just doesn't always work. That darkness gets, it seeps into the bone marrow, and that's what happens to people. The other thing about making people laugh, and this whole idea of who loves me. Oh, by the way, I should mention that I once saw, apropos of all this, I saw a documentary on Chagall. He was interviewed when he was way into, like he was in his late 80s or something like that. I think he lived to be 90 or 90-something. And here's this little old guy with this really sweet face and his melancholy eyes. And somebody asked him, not all Chagall's stuff was all this beautiful dreamlike stuff, some of which, you know, was, you know, he's an artist, so he'd get away with what other people would be describing as kind of madness, right? But beautiful, beautiful paintings. But some of his earlier stuff, Chagall's earlier stuff, because of experiences that he had, you know, growing up in a small village as a Jew, probably in Russia, before he came to Paris. Some of them, his earlier paintings, are very dark, extremely dark and forbidding. They asked him later on in his life, and I don't know how this is, talk about a non sequitur. They asked him, it's a stupid question, to what do you attribute your great genius? And Chagall had this beautiful little, like almost childlike smile on his face. And he said, my mother loved me very much. My mother loved me very much. Remember The Elephant Man? Remember that movie? Same thing. But he was making it up. Chagall was not making it up. His mother loved him very much. I know I'm beating this Freudian horse to death. I always do this all the time, but I guess I'm concerned about it myself when I try to figure out who I am all the time. But obviously, Robin Williams did not have this. And another thing about comedians is the neglect makes them sad. It gives them this darkness, this unlovableness, right? But there are other... I mean, think of this in a wider way. A lot of blacks and a lot of Jews have gone into entertainment. They've gone into comedy. They've gone into dancing. They've become clowns. The blacks had a word for it called putting on old massa, right? They make jokes, right? They make jokes. And the Jews are, a lot of Jews are comedians, right? It's an anger. There is an anger there. There's an anger there. The neglect sometimes lead to a kind of an anger, too. So when somebody like Robin Williams, and he's an example of somebody who is very kind and generous, and there's endless stories about that. But then you get people like Don Rickles, his insult comedy, and you get people who, you know, this black comedians and Jewish comedians, Richard Pryor, who thrive on just vicious. I mean, they're hysterical and they're very funny. But they thrive on this kind of vicious, insulting humor. There is a theme and a thread through almost every comedian's humor, which is sort of like getting even with the world. The way of making people laugh, when you make people laugh, it can be almost like getting even with the world. If it's the only thing that you is a fat, unlovable, funny-looking minority, whatever, if it's the only thing you could do to get people to pay attention to you and to get people to at least give you something, money or attention or whatever, you do that, right? If it's the only thing. If you get angry, the angry black man, right? If you get angry, you know, the loudmouth Jew. No, you make jokes. Ha, 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 Woody Allen, you know. Ha, 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 Richard Pryor. But there is an element, I believe, in many, if not most comedians, take a guy like Seinfeld, too. I couldn't stand the Seinfeld show. I like the individual characters, except for Seinfeld, who looked like a real son of a bitch to me, a cold, arrogant guy, and it bothered me. There is an aspect of anger and rage that runs through a lot of this stuff. If you ever see a lot of stand-up comedians, you will see that anger. And I've known comedians. When I was doing some performing for several years back in the 90s, I knew a lot of comedians. And there's a way of, I like to make people laugh, and I felt good about it. But there's a certain vast group of comedians, guys like Seinfeld and even other comedians, and maybe even Robin Williams had that and didn't realize it or didn't like it. It's the only way you have of controlling people. Otherwise, your life is out of control because the emptiness is inside you and it makes you feel lost. And comedians used to use this phrase. I don't know if they still do. But one comedian would ask another comedian after he comes off stage, how did you do? And he'd say, I killed. That's what they used to say. I killed them. I killed them. What an extraordinary thing to say. So I think that there is that kind of... I had a run-in. Not a run-in. What's a silly? That's an exaggeration. But I had a little problem with Seinfeld once, personally. How did that happen? I wasn't working with him, believe me. I wasn't that high up in the world. But I was playing pool with my son in a really sort of... upper middle class kind of really nice pool hall, very quiet, very nice place on the Upper West Side of Manhattan where Seinfeld was living at the time. And playing pool with him, and I love playing pool, right? That beautiful green table and the way the balls click into each other. And I'm playing with my son's about, he's about 11 or 12 years old. And this woman comes in, and usually women didn't come in by themselves to play pool. Not because it was a sleazy place, it just wasn't something that women did or were interested in. This was actually the opposite of a sleazy place. It was a kind of a high-class place that had a little cafe and all. This really sort of attractive woman comes in and, you know, is assigned the table next to us, and she sort of nodded pleasantly and nodded at her and said hello. And she's playing, you know, desultorily. She's just sort of, you know, hitting the ball back and forth a little bit. And she's looking at her watch. She's obviously waiting for somebody. And Jerry Seinfeld shows up. It was his, I learned later on, it was his girlfriend at the time who he later married. And he started talking to her like you would talk to a dog. He was nasty and insulting. And everything that I always felt about him, I mean, you know, and I'm not making a totality of a judgment on the goodness or badness of Seinfeld's personality or his own, you know, self based on this. But it didn't surprise me, put it that way, after watching his show. He's talking to this woman and he's insulting her. He's talking down to her. And at one point, my son, who was sort of flustered by the idea that Jerry Seinfeld was at the next table, right? He hit the ball, and like people will do sometimes who aren't very good at playing pool, the ball goes flying through the air to the next table. It went right over off the pool table, and it lands at Seinfeld's feet. And he picked up the ball and tossed it to me, practically threw it at me. And he had a look on his face like, can't you get that stupid kid to do things right and stop bothering me? What a prick this guy was, it seems to me. And he was angry. A lot of there's a kind of violence and anger in comedians that's really extraordinary if you see it and if you could feel it sometimes. I mean, you could just see it and you could just hear it.
Really funny. What do you mean I'm funny? It's funny, you know. It's a good story. It's funny. You're a funny guy.
What do you mean? You mean the way I talk? What?
It's just, you know, you're just funny. It's funny, you know, the way you tell the story and everything.
Funny how? I mean, what's funny about it?
Yeah, Tommy, no, you got it all wrong.
Oh, Anthony. He's a big boy. He knows what he said. What'd you say?
You're right.
Funny how? What?
Just, you know, you're funny.
You mean, let me understand this, because maybe it's me, I'm a little fucked up, maybe. But I'm funny how? I mean, funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you. I make you laugh. I'm here to fucking amuse you. What do you mean funny? Funny how? How am I funny?
I'm not just, you know how you tell a story. What?
No, I don't know. You said it. How do I know? You said I'm funny. How the fuck am I funny? What the fuck is so funny about me? Tell me. Tell me what's funny.
Get the fuck out of here, Tommy.
You motherfucker. I almost had him. I almost had him. Yeah, stuttering prick.
Yeah, sorry. Sorry about the language. But, you know, it's not so funny sometimes. It's not so funny. I mean, I love to watch stand-up comedy. I watched Louis C.K. do some stand-up comedy because a friend of mine told me that he had seen Louis. Is it Louis C.K.? I think that's his name. And it was too nasty for me. I guess I'm getting very, very oatmealish in the head. I'm getting very cornballish and I don't know. In my old age, anything that's violent or nasty does not appeal to me the way it did when I was younger. But I could see it. I mean, the guy's brilliant, he's smart, and he's funny. And I used to enjoy all those, stand-up comedians. And to me, but now when I look at stand-up comedians, and I know people who felt that way a little bit about Robin Williams, or maybe more than a little bit, that sometimes, and I felt that way myself sometimes, it wasn't a nastiness. That's not what you felt from him, that you did feel that from people like Louis C.K. A guy who I would pick out who was on the other end of that, who you never felt any nastiness from whatsoever, no matter what he said or how critical he was, all you felt from him was gentleness and kindness. And he had his own troubles, by the way, too, with drugs and with drinking, was George Carlin. The name of his album was Class Clown. By the way, Robin Williams was voted in his high school yearbook. He was voted funniest and least likely to succeed. How's that? He was voted funniest and least likely to succeed. But a guy on the other end of the spectrum where you didn't feel that kind of desperation so much, and you didn't feel, although it was there, obviously, you never felt any kind of fishhook or barb or any kind of like any kind of smack coming right after the joke, was Carlin. And he went through his own hell that way. He was consumed by depression at times, and he was a drinker, and I think he took drugs too as well, and he had to be in rehab many times. This happens with comedians, and I knew other comedians too. I worked with Louis Black once. You know Louis Black? Louis Black, sometimes, I don't know where he is these days. I know he's constantly on the road doing stand-up or sit-down, whatever he's doing these days. But sometimes he was on Jon Stewart, put him on Comedy Central every once in a while. Does he still go on Jon Stewart's Comedy Central? I don't know. He had a segment called Back in Black on Jon Stewart. Now, Jon Stewart's another one. I saw a clip of Jon Stewart doing some stand-up at Boston when Jon Stewart started out as a stand-up comedian. And he had that thing in him. And as Jon Stewart, you feel both things coming at him, a kind of decency and a kind of urge to make people feel good. But he has that edge of hysteria, and he can be angry, too. And when he was doing stand-up, his stand-up comedians could be very, very angry. So I used to work with Louis Black when I had a performing career for several years back in the 90s. I would get up on stage and tell my stories, not kind of like essays like I do here, but actually a beginning, middle, and end story of something that happened to me when I was a kid, a particular thing, or an incident that happened to me, a fascinating or funny or interesting or sad or tragic or a beautiful incident that happened to me when I was a probation officer or I worked at the welfare department. And I probably will tell some more of those stories as the weeks and months go by, because I miss telling those stories. They have a kind of a beginning, middle, and end, and they have a structure to them, and I always feel good at the end of them and try to make other people feel good. But so I used to tell these stories, which were often very, very serious and about the most extreme serious things, but, you know, plenty of humor and self-deprecatory remarks. But Louis Black, it was at a place called Downtown Theater Bar or whatever, or the Downtown Bar Theater. It was on 42nd Street in New York, right across the street from a whole bunch of where these theaters are still there, of off Broadway and off Broadway theaters, and right across the street. So you get show people coming there all the time. And this place, a lot of comedians, and it was a really kind of great space. It was a small space, maybe 100 people would fit in there, and it was downstairs from a very nice restaurant and bar. And they had jazz trios there. They had they tried out various parts of one-act plays. I mean, they had everything going on. It was a wonderful place. I think it still exists, but I'm not really sure. I haven't been there in a long time. But when I was performing initially, and then throughout the years when I performed, I loved this place. And when I get up on stage and tell these stories, and like I say, a lot of them involve, you know, issues about life and death, about suicide of people in my family, about mental hospitals, about, and they all had endings where I felt good about them because I was able to lift people up at the end. I didn't, you know, it wasn't some relentless downer. But Louis Black was the MC, and this was back in his early days when he hadn't made it that big yet, and he was trying to make it as a stand-up comedian. He was the MC of this club, and I don't know for sure, and I don't want to slander or libel. I don't want to libel poor Louis, but it seemed to me that he was oiled. He was well-oiled all the time, and Louis would get up there with that black suit he wears, and he was... It was part of his persona, and it is part of his persona to be, you see how he is, right? He like loses it. He gets enraged and he turns red in the face and he yells. That's part of what Louis's thing is. What he's really like in person, I don't know, because I just interacted with him at the nightclub. But he would get up and he would do his raging, and he would talk about his parents and he would talk about everything, and he would talk about how much he hates this and he hates that. And he would start bellowing and he'd turn red in the face. And it was very difficult to come on after Louis Black to tell my, my touching, sad, uplifting stories. It was very difficult. One time he got on there, and he would go on and on and on. I mean, my act was like an hour and 15 minutes, which is long enough to sit through, right, without people getting restless. And Louis would go on. He'd just go on and on. And one time I'm sitting backstage. It wasn't much of a, you know, it wasn't a very big place. and you could hear everything went on backstage, so you had to be quiet, right? One time Lewis is screaming, and my fucking parents, and he's going screaming, and I said in a very loud voice, Lewis, enough already, from behind the stage. And he started laughing, and he said, all right, ladies and gentlemen, Mike Fader. So I'd come out on stage. Or sometimes I'd walk out and I'd say, thank you very much, Lewis. I'm going to try right now to see if I can rescue. He used to provoke people. He would get, that was his thing, is to get people really angry. What? I don't know. But he was in a rage. Well, so have I been in my life. But I noticed when I was performing that it was an extraordinary feeling. I would have horrible, horrible stage fright. I'd be backstage. And how did it come out? I'd break things up and smash things. If I was backstage at a theater, I would punch my hand into a wall sometimes. I would, one time I took a prop, I didn't even know what it was, and I smacked it with my foot and broke it. I was always hitting things and yelling and saying, God damn it, why do I have to do it? I mean, I was always angry. I was angry that I had to do it. And that anger is difficult to deal with. I mean, you have to, my director, may she rest in peace, Betty Osborne, her name was, she said, one thing it's important for an actor, and I guess I was a performer same way, even though I was just telling autobiographical stories, was you have to understand how you feel that evening. Before you walk out on stage, even if you're playing a regular part, before you walk out on stage, get a good handle on how you feel, or else you're going to go off in some way, and you're going to be off. You're not going to be able to hold people's attention, and they won't understand. It's like you're out of tune. So she said, you tune up, you know, you understand how you feel. And I was always angry, and a lot of comedians, you know, they're pissed off, they're angry all the time. And the trouble I had with performing was that it was an extraordinary experience. It's one thing to be on the radio where you don't see anybody, right? Even though you know people are listening, you don't see anybody. So I'm all alone here in the studio. Only the engineer sometimes is with you in a room. In this case, the engineer is on the outside. And you don't see anybody. But the performing experience I had was when I was on, so to speak, when I was good, when I was really completely centered and focused, was everybody was intently listening to me. And it's no mistake why I went into this kind of business. And you can see this with performers. This happens with any live performer. I don't know about dancers, but probably any really, really good live performer. There's a lot of live performers, singers, dancers, comedians, actors, that just aren't, they don't compel your attention. And that's an important thing. You remember earlier in that article, the guy said he didn't know if Robin Williams was acting under inspiration or compulsion. It's impossible. And he said also, the A.O. Scott said, the reporter said here, the critic, that it's hard to tell the difference, or maybe there's no difference between the two. It is hard to tell the difference with performers, where they're compelled to do it, especially one-person shows like stand-up comedians or the kind of show I did or Spalding Gray used to do. And there are other people, too. When you do a one-person show, you are acting under inspiration and compulsion. But any performer who gets out there, like a lead singer or somebody, think of somebody like Mick Jagger. I'm just picking him out of a hat. This sort of dates me, too, but I'm an old guy anyhow. The lead singer, the lead dancer, the lead anybody, they have a need in them, a deep need in them to compel you to watch them and to listen to them. When I was on stage, I had this same need to make up for, I'm saying this in retrospect, I didn't quite understand it then, the fact that nobody was paying any attention to me whatsoever when I was a kid. I could have been on the moon as far as they were concerned. I could have been, filing the firing pins off, the serial numbers off pistols and murdering people in another town. I could have been stuffing skulls with candles. They had no idea what I was doing and paid no attention to me, except unless I was making noise and upsetting my mother. That was the one thing you couldn't do. Go outside. Go play. Go away. Be quiet. Okay. So that I did. So I went outside and played with toy soldiers a lot. A lot of time I spent playing with toy soldiers in the dirt in the back of my house by myself. And I spent a lot of time by myself. And even more, I used to wander around the cemetery in the back of my house talking, yes, entertaining the tombstones. Now, how's that? I just say, after I had a particularly good show when I was entertaining the tombstones, I could easily say I killed them. But, you know, I didn't. They were dead already. This is a kind of gallows humor, right? So here I am, right, in the nightclub, and I learned that if I was really good and really on, that every single person, 100 pair of eyes, 200 eyes, right? They're lucky if we're all lucky. 100 people are paying rapt attention to me, rapt attention to me. And it was exhilarating for me. And it gave me a sense, not consciously, of power and control over my life that I had in no other place and no other way. And it's before I got there, I felt sort of lost, like I always had felt. And after this tremendous high, and then you get this applause at the end, and you could feel people laughing hysterically if you say something funny, or even crying if you say something really touching or moving. And it's an extraordinary experience. And it got to be, though, that after these shows, I would crash so bad that for days afterwards, I was in a tremendous depression. And I didn't take coke, you know, and I wasn't into pills of any sorts. And all I did was drink a lot of coffee to try to keep from, but the darkness. So all that running, all that dance, bang, bang, moving your feet, all that gerbil wheeling, all that frozen gas pedal to the metal, all that constant performing, being on all the time. Performers, a lot of performers will work constantly. They will work constantly. They'll do 5, 6, 7, 8 shows a week, and they won't even take a break. And they'll travel everywhere and always be that persona that they have. They can't unfreeze it. They can't stop it. They'll be like the little cartoon character who almost falls off the edge of the cliff, because that's where the abyss is. And Robin Williams, God help him, finally found that he couldn't escape the abyss. I mean, basically what he did was he crucified himself on a cross of comedy, in a way. It's like he was trying to absorb the pain and sorrow of the world and be universally loved in return. I think that's the way you might put it. And one thing to notice about Robin Williams was that he was a great villain. And I think that's very interesting when you think back on all the ways he made people laugh. And he had a tremendously kind, gentle side, obviously. But when he was playing serial killers and villains in movies, he was scary. He was scary because that's in there. It lurks in there. I don't know if I have enough time to tell this story, but this is something from Groucho Marx. It's from his 1959 book, Groucho and Me. I'm sure most of you, he says, have heard the story of the man who, desperately ill, goes to an analyst and tells the doctor that he has lost his desire to live and that he is seriously considering suicide. The doctor listens to this tale of melancholia and then tells the patient that what he needs is a good belly laugh, and don't we all? He advises the unhappy man to go to the circus that night and spend the evening laughing at Grock, the world's funniest clown. The doctor sums it up. After you have seen Grock, I'm sure you will be much happier. The patient rises to his feet, looks sadly at the doctor, turns and ambles to the door. As he starts to leave, the doctor says, "By the way, what is your name?" The man turns and regards the analyst with sorrowful eyes. "I am Grock." Yeah, it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And it's balm and it's healing. It's a wonderful thing to be able to make people laugh. It's a wonderful thing to be able to make people laugh. It's such a hard, tough world that we live in. And when somebody's good at making people laugh, it's a great, great thing. And you love it when you see it and you feel good about it. But as Mr. Silver, the owner of my neighborhood candy store when I was a kid, said, as he took my nickel for some candy, "There's a price to pay for everything, kid."
so much for what he did. They gave this ball boy his fortune and fame. Since that day, he ain't been the same. See the man with the stage fright, just standing up there to give it all his might. And he got caught in the spotlight. But when we get to the end, you want to start off.